time for The Outspoken Cyclist, the weekly conversation about cycles, cyclists, travel, trails, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. WJCU broadcasts and streams The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show at 8 a.m. every Saturday morning. In Northeast Ohio, tune in to 88.7 FM, or worldwide, listen in at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for February 13th, 2021. Happy Valentine's Day. First, of course, is Radiothon, our once-a-year big fundraiser for WJCU. The website opened Friday, February 12th, and we are counting on you to help us reach our goal of $50,000 for this year's Come Together for WJCU 2021 Radiothon. Even if you don't live in the Northeast Ohio area or listen to WJCU 88.7 FM on a regular basis, you are listening to this podcast. And without WJCU, I'm not sure where I'd be. The college hosts the Outspoken Cyclist show, as well as great original programming all week long. So once a year, for just 10 days, we ask our loyal listeners to help us out with a donation. All the funds raised during Radiothon stay right here in the studios to help buy new equipment, as well as provide funds for the ongoing maintenance required to keep the station at the number one spot for college radio in Northeast Ohio. So won't you please go to WJCU.org, click the Pledge Online button, and make your donation. The website will be open until midnight on Sunday, February 21st, and no amount is too small. Many thank yous. So our show this week features two incredibly passionate and fascinating people. The first, George Mount, is not new to The Outspoken Cyclist. He's an ex-pro, a Bicycle Hall of Fame inductee, and way, way more. When you want the truth about anything in the bicycle racing world, just ask George. He has much to say about the state of cycling in the U.S., and he says it in a clear and informed way. Our second guest is no less passionate about bicycles and racing, only his approach is from a very different perspective. Did you know that 1.3%, or upwards of 3 million people in the U.S., were reported as being diagnosed with IBD, either as ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, in a 2015 study? The disease is not only debilitating, it can also be embarrassing and scary. Corey Greenberg, now in his early 30s, found out about IBD and specifically ulcerative colitis while racing on a U23 team about 10 years ago, as many young people who believe that it will just go away on its own sometimes like to believe. He began experiencing the pain, inflammation, and accompanying symptoms of what eventually flared into full-blown ulcerative colitis, forcing him off his bike and into the hospital. His approach to healing, accompanied by his commitment to his sport, have brought him two major achievements so far: remission and a pro racing career. And today we'll hear that story. So back in 2013, when we last spoke with George Mount, he was still living in Northern California and was giving us the inside scoop on the Bicycle Hall of Fame. Fast forward to today, and George is now living the serene retired life in Oregon and working on a book about bicycling in Northern California back in the day. He hasn't lost any of his passion for the sport and has some very insightful commentary about USA Cycling. He really wants to see fundamental changes inside the organization and its boards of directors. Boards? As in plural? Hi, George. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Wow, it's been a long time since we last spoke. In fact, it was 2013. A few things have changed since then, yes?
Seems like it was not that long ago, but a few things have changed. I mean, I no longer live in California. I live in Oregon. And in a rural forest alongside the Rogue River out in the country.
Well, you used to do a lot of high tech stuff. Now you're not doing that. Does it feel weird to not be like crazy all the time with following up on a million different tasks?
So, you know, I still read Dilbert every morning because that was my life for 30 years. And all it does is remind me how much I don't miss it at all.
That's just awesome. Well, I do want to talk about something that you and I both participated in a couple of weeks ago. Maybe it was 3 weeks already. And that is you and a whole bunch of people, Connie Carpenter, Davis Finney, Wayne Stetna, Bill Humphreys, and USA Cycling. There was so much pushback when it first was announced about this Olympic Development Academy that Rob DeMartini wanted to get some feedback. And Bill Humphreys reached out and said, I've got a whole bunch of people. And you sat in on that. You didn't say anything, as I remember, but you did sit in on that.
That's correct. I didn't say anything. I didn't feel like I heard anything worth commenting on, frankly.
Interesting. So what did you see and what did you hear? And why did you have nothing to input? You always have something to say.
Well, so here's the thing with USA Cycling that a lot of people don't understand. And I've tried to explain this to people online, and people just kind of shake their heads and don't understand it. And realize in part that my knowledge and understanding of what's going on has a lot to do with the fact that I worked for 30 years in the tech industry. I worked in startups. I sat in board meetings with people who are on the board of USA Cycling, on the money-raising board. And I know these people. I worked with these people. I rode my bikes with these people. I was in high tech for a long time. I know which people in which companies are honest and which ones are dishonest, because I've sat in board meetings, done fundraising, talked to people who have and did work in those companies, saw their presentations, and so on. So I know and understand money people from the tech world. And what we have is we have two boards of directors in USA Cycling. One is the USA Cycling Board of Directors, and then there's a money raising group on the side. It's a separate 501c corporation, and it's run by Tom Weisel and a bunch of his friends who are from the money world. Now, there are other people on the board, and some of the people are good people. And a lot of people I don't know, some of them I do know or know about, and I know those types of people. I know we shouldn't throw people into sort of one basket, but people who have made a lot of money off of making a lot of money, it is pretty easy to see who they are and where their motivations are. And that board essentially pulls and owns the purse strings for USA Cycling. The bottom line is that whether you're the president of USA Cycling like DeMartini and the people who have come before him or anybody else on that board, if you don't do what these guys bid you to do, you don't last there long or you don't have any power. Okay, it's a weird political thing. And as far as I'm concerned, and I don't know DeMartini at all. He seems like he's an okay guy. The guy before him seemed like an okay guy. I've met other guys who seem like okay guys. And all of a sudden, at some point, they start trying to do something and then they disappear. And I suspect that, and a lot of this stuff takes place behind closed doors or in meetings and hallways, because that's how this degree happens, that unless something is done that panders to people's personal whims on the money-raising board, it just doesn't happen. And the people who are on that particular board, I call them the shadow board. There's nothing really shadowy about it. They're there. Their names are all out there, although there's no links of information to them. But you can look them up. They're all you can look them all up on Google. That, you know, unless they have some pet thing that they want to do, it doesn't happen. And so, because of that, I look on any major initiative, such as the one that DeMartini is proposing, as something that probably came up because it's a pet thing for somebody or somebody's friend who's on the shadow board. And what it means is, to me, as somebody who's seen pay-to-play in cycling since the 70s, just in different ways, it means that somebody or somebody's friend's kid didn't get to go to Colorado Springs. And so they're going to come up with a way so that their kid can go to Colorado Springs, so that they can put it on their resume when they apply to go to Yale or Stanford or Princeton and say that they were on the USA, you know, national cycling team and they were great athletes. You know, Hollywood stars seem to do this, calling their daughters, you know, rowers and so on and so forth, so they can, you know, pay a lot of money to get them into particular universities. And this is just another way for somebody's pet thing to happen. Now, you'll never be able to track it down. You'll never be able to prove it. You'll never be able to figure out who it was, because like I said, none of this stuff is documented. But as far as I'm concerned, this has been going on for a long time. It's not just cycling. And I don't see how this is really designed in any way other than to pander to somebody who's got the control of the strings of the actual USA Cycling Board. So, you know, I don't see how my comments are going to make this change or make anything happen in a different way. And I don't think, I'm sure Demartini knows what's going on and where it's coming from, because he's probably the one, he's probably, you know, been taken aside and had that conversation and been told this is a great thing. And he may have bought into it wholeheartedly, or just know that you have to go to where your bread is buttered. But I just don't see, well, I don't see this particular version of pay to play being a way that improves the sport in any way. And I don't see how it's going to last, because once somebody gets their way and gets their kid in and they're able to do their bragging rights and stuff, unless more of these rich guys come along and want to fund it, I just don't see happening. And if you remember, Demartini even admitted on the call that this thing isn't going to pay for itself. You know, there's still going to be money coming out of the pockets of all the other people that support USA Cycling, i.e. those who pay dues and those who promote bike races. So, you know, I mean, it's something. They're trying to do something to move the sport forward in a way. I don't see how my comments to them are going to make any difference, and they're not going to listen to me when I tell them what I'm telling you.
So two things. One is, of course, people are going to say you're just cynical, but you have a really long history and background with USA Cycling. So it's not like you haven't been there, done that, and seen it. On the other hand, if this isn't going to work, if this is just going to be yet another thing, what would make a difference? What do you see, given your experience and your history with the sport, and even in business, what do you think would make a difference? And will cycling ever be a sport that is going to be looked at as a popular sport here in the U.S.?
Those are very difficult questions to answer. I think that USA Cycling has some bearing on how the sport grows. And I think that the way the board of directors is set up and the makeup of the board of directors, and whether these board of directors do something and do something that's not in their personal self-interest, has some influence on that. But I don't know how you can control that other than to get rid of, I mean, look, you've got two separate boards. One board, the fundraising board, is supposed to raise money, and they raise money for pet projects. Those pet projects are all listed on the thing. That's got to stop. That board should not exist. If they want to raise money, raise some freaking money. Most of the people that are on that board could completely personally fund USA Cycling with the money that they use to fund their yachts and their mistresses. So why are these people on this board so that they can brag about being on the board, and they're not really raising money that goes to the regular board that are the people that should have the control over how the funds get spent? And if you're going to leave them on this special board, this special nonprofit board that pulls the purse strings, then there should be a little bit more obligation to actually raise money and not have the control over that money. So nothing's going to happen as long as this has been the way it's been since this board was formed. It hasn't changed. There have been times when there's been more money for the sport, but that's primarily come in from these individuals on this board funding or finding the funds. In most cases, these guys find the funds through people who are their customers or their friends. They're at the country club to support a professional cycling team so that they get to go and hang out at the professional bike races and go to the Tour de France and so on and so forth. So I haven't seen this board do anything appreciably great in many years. Obviously, they did some beginning good things that turned into bad things. And everybody's smarting from that still. I mean, I'm involved in the Cycling Hall of Fame, and we haven't been able to get any money for the Cycling Hall of Fame for years since the whole Lance debacle, because nobody wants to touch cycling. You know, I don't know. I mean, you've got to fix that whole board of directors dysfunctional shadow board system that's taking place. And you've got to actually let the board execute what they do on the board. One of the other problems with boards of directions of national governing bodies, or NGBs, and not just cycling, this is pretty common, is a lot of people that are on these boards as stepping stones in order to work their way up to get to the USOC boards, and or into more more well-funded sport. So I see people on the board that really don't have any cycling background, and they're on the board for a couple of years, and then they move on to another sport. You've got guys that headed USA Cycling and went to gymnastics. Yeah, what happened to that guy? Resigned in disgrace over all the gymnastics stuff. He moved up in the world real well. There's a lot of these games that happen in the, under the USOPC, as it's called now, and the national governing bodies. And, really, until you can fix the USOPC, which is a big problem, and a lot of people have been working very hard, and there was recently some legislation passed last year to try to help fix that, to put athletes on the boards and that kind of stuff. The NGBs, the next level down, like USA Cycling, they're going to try to mimic USOPC, and USOPC is inherently and just incredibly filled with people that shouldn't be on these boards. And again, though, some of those people are working their way up from USOPC to the IOC. And it's all about prestige and personal, ego stroking for most of these people that have money. And then you've got, some small percent of people that actually are from the sport and really care about the sport. I mean, we've got some of those people. Those are the people that should be running things, not the money people who come in and are just using this as a game. And like I said, I know these people. I lived in Silicon Valley. I hung out with them and their kin and their peers and people, and heard the stories and saw things. And it's all ego stroking for rich pukes. For a lot of them, they don't really
don't
care
hold
about the
back,
sport.
George, damn it, just don't.
Well,
hold
they don't
back.
Care about the sport. They move from one sport to the other.
That's what's sad. That I don't like. Let me reintroduce you. If you don't know, I'm speaking with George Mount. George never holds back. He will tell you exactly what he thinks, which is one of the big reasons I'm talking with him today. So I don't even know where to go with this, other than to say we had a year off in a way. When you think about it, 2020 was an off year. Nobody did anything in the sport other than hopefully got out for a ride pretty much alone. Do you think 2021, are people going to look at it and say, maybe we need to do things differently this year? Or do you think it's just going to be more of the same?
No, it'll just kind of crank back up again. It'll be pretty much more of the same. I mean, how are you going to change? The people that control the change are the people that you want out, and the people that can affect change and that care about the sport. They don't have the money, and they don't have the chops to fight back against the people that are there just for their egos.
What about this group that was on this call, the Bill Humphreys put together? So you have all of these past stars of cycling. They must know what you know, or do they not?
I think some of them know, and most people just don't think about it or talk about it. And a lot of them don't have the background of knowledge of who these people are and haven't dug into I've looked up the bio of everybody that's on the board of directors and the shadow board. And I know who a lot of these people are, and I know who's running things. Most people don't understand just how corrupt the money making people are, and the venture capitalists and those kind of people. Not all of them. I have friends that are retired venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, very good friends, but the people that are there to stroke their own egos by being on boards of sports organizations are not the best of them. They may have made the most amount of money, but they've done that because they're the least, the most corrupt, frankly.
So we're looking at something that sort of mirrors politics.
Absolutely.
It's too bad. So now we have an Olympic year coming up.
Maybe.
Well, that's true. We might have an Olympic year coming up. It's already been postponed 1 year, but it may go to 2022. You're absolutely right. How about funding the Olympics? So it seems to me that we're one of the only countries who really doesn't support our athletes very well when it comes to international competitions like the Olympics. How could that change?
The whole system is so screwed up. Right. I mean, I don't care what anybody says. This new Olympic committee, commit thing, whatever they call it, for the kids.
The Olympic Development Academy, the ODA.
Development Academy.
Right.
It's always in the U.S. and in a lot of countries, it's always been to some degree a pay-to-play situation to make the U.S. national team. And it's not just Olympic teams. I mean, in professional cycling in Europe, there's a lot of pay to play. There's a lot of guys that get on teams because they're willing to get on a team, and either they or their family pays money or pays something in kind. For example, free hotel rooms for the teams when they're, you know, passing through town during stage races, for a father or father-in-law of somebody who's, you know, who almost kind of could have, should have, maybe couldn't quite make a pro team, but now he's going to be on a pro team, and they don't really pay him a salary, and he's got to buy his own jerseys. I mean, it's not that uncommon. And as I said, all sports suffer this, but you know, there's been a pretty blatant pay-to-play history in USA cycling, a lot of which has been very abusive of the athletes, especially female athletes. I know back when we were racing, you'd wonder how some person got on a national team, and a lot of times it involved hidden abuses that were going on, especially with women riders. And, you know, everybody kind of knew about it, but nobody said anything. And, you know, it's all gets swept under the table. You've got to eliminate that. There are movements afoot for honesty in sports. Having coaches, take classes on, how not to be a dishonest person. Of course, they don't require that of board members to USA Cycling or anything like that. There's no real ethical requirement to be a board member of most sports, as far as I know. There's just so many things you can fix.
It's so interesting to me that you have to teach somebody how to be ethical. It seems like such an oxymoron to me. I don't understand how people are just inherently unethical.
I don't think you can teach an unethical person how to be ethical. I think
that's
you can
what
only
I'm
teach
saying.
An unethical person how to appear to be ethical and not get caught, honestly.
That's a different can of worms. Wow. So do you see any bright light for cycling in the future?
Well, you asked earlier about roles for people like myself and other people that have been involved in the sport in the past. I don't really see that they, most of the people you're talking about actually have at least one ethical bone in their body.
Yes, they do. As far as I can tell, I've talked to a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I don't see a lot of role, because those people would come in and they would see the situation and they would have to leave. Or they'd have to become, willing to look the other way on all the stuff that goes on. And, there are, when you get down to lower levels, there's lots of good ethical people, I'm sure, working in the sports. And there's most of those people there because they have a passion for the sport. I mean, you don't make a lot of money in cycling. You stay involved because you do it for the passion. But, I know there's a lot of money rolling around. I'd like to see some of that roll down to the people that do the actual work and not be used to pay for hot shots to have expensive hotel rooms at the World Championships and Olympics and stuff, which I'm sure still goes on.
Well, so the last thing I want to talk about is George Mount's future. What are you doing?
I'm working on a book.
Oh, good.
The book is, and it's kind of stalled because I still need to interview a bunch of people, and I like to do it face to face. And the book really is about the San Francisco Bay Area in the 1970s and what came out of it in the world of cycling. And what came out of it in the world of cycling was not just, well, Northern California, okay? Northern California, Northern Nevada, District 1 is a place that spawned a number of tremendous bike racers, but also a number of tremendously talented bike racers that quit fairly early on. But in addition, a tremendous amount of ideas and innovation. And the ideas and innovation, not only in training, I mean, for example, one of the things I innovated was, cross training with other sports, stuff like that, that a lot of people didn't do. Well, they did in the Midwest with skating and stuff, but it was considered, I mean, even my coach in the 1976 Olympics told me I had to stop lifting weights because it was bad for me.
In those days, that's what they thought.
Yeah. And, don't do cyclocross if you want to be a road racer. And if you're a road racer, you can either climb or you can time trial, but you can't do both. I mean, there were just so many rules and things, crap out there. But so there's a lot of innovations taking place in that. But, also what else came out of Northern California? The mountain bike, the Giro bicycle helmet. Specialized bicycles There's a whole slew of technological developments, and all of this happened at the same time that the tech industry came out of the same area, and it was the same kids in the same neighborhoods. One guy was going down to his neighbor's garage and playing with electronics. The other guy was riding his bike up in the hills, and some of them were doing both. And it was a, I call it the soup. It was a particular minestrone of stuff that came together starting in the early 70s through the 80s. And so I've been interviewing a bunch of the people that were the movers and the shakers back then, not just the people who did it, but also the people that surrounded it. And as I told one guy, he says, why are you interviewing me? I go, because you were a supplier. You supplied us with, you know, wheels and stuff like that. You were like the pusher.
Right.
And you have an interesting perspective on how this happened and how did it come about. So that particular soup, I mean, I've got idea in my head. I've got a lot of information. I've started writing it a few times. I just need to do a couple more interviews. And then the question is, would it make any money? Is it really worth the effort?
Well, you know, so there are a couple ways to look at that. You know, writers write, artists do their art, and riders ride. So if you really want to write it, write it. They will come.
Well, I've been writing bits and pieces and putting it out there on Patrick Brady Cycling Independent site, where you guys are linked to. And
yes, we are.
You know, the response to some of the stories I've written have all been really good.
There you go.
And so that's been encouraging.
Serialize and, it. Turn it into a podcast.
Yeah, that's, we'll see. We'll see. Right. I've been cutting a lot of wood, taking some trees down on the property. Getting really good with the chainsaw and the splitter.
George Mount and, chainsaw massacrist.
Well,
massacring trees. Yeah.
Well, I only take down the dead ones.
I understand. I have any pets up there? Do you have a pet?
I have a dog and a couple cats. And, nice. And then we have a herd of deer that come by every day and eat carrots out of your hands.
Oh, do they really? That's adorable.
We've had mountain lions walk right by the kitchen while we're eating dinner, and somebody saw a herd of elk the other day on the other side of the river.
You know, it sounds like a gorgeous place to be.
Yeah. I mean, I can ride my bike in 10 minutes down to the river, a private little area that just a few people have a key to, and go fishing and go hiking and shoot my pistol and drink beer. And you know, it's just, it's very nice.
Well, I really appreciate your perspective, and I appreciate you talking with me about it. I think the more perspectives we have, maybe we can start moving the needle a little bit. You know, I still believe in cycling as a sport. I think it's a great sport. I think it's a great sport for anybody. So you don't have to be, you know, big, and you don't have to be little, and you don't have to be whatever. You can get on a bike and ride. So...
Yeah, I agree. I love the sport. I'm completely passionate about it. I'm still involved in the Hall of Fame. I mean, we're actually right in the middle of creating. I'm still looking for more nominations for the Cycling Hall of Fame. So people should send those to the Hall of Fame if they haven't. And the one thing I'd leave you with is that USA Cycling is not going to grow unless they embrace different perspectives. And unfortunately, like most sports, if you differ in points of view, and see things that that people that are running the sport see, and they disagree with it, that you're shut out. And that's not a way that you're successful in sport or business. You know, you have to embrace diversity, you know, like Lincoln did with bringing in his, you know, group of rivals.
Right.
I would love to help USA Cycle. I would love to be involved more. I think all those are the people that you listed on, you know, names on, would love to be involved more, would love to have more say. But USA Cycling is the one that controls that. And obviously over the many, many decades I've been involved, there hasn't been a chance for them to really be involved because they sometimes are critical of things.
And by the way, out of criticism, perhaps there's some growth. Well, George, thank you so much for talking with me. I hope you get that book going because I want to be the first one to review it.
Well, it'll get done because I have to do it.
Right. There you have it. Have a wonderful winter, what's left of it. Yeah. And hopefully we'll get to talk again soon.
Sure. Anytime.
All right, George. Take care.
All right. Bye. Thanks. Bye.
Bye. George Mount joined me with his usual informed commentary about cycling in the U.S. and what he thinks it would take to make changes to advance the sport. I, for one, am looking forward to reading his book, so he'd better hurry up and get it done. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, I'll introduce you to Corey Greenberg. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. Before we get to my conversation with Corey, I want to take another few seconds to remind you that Radiothon 2021 is up and running. Won't you please log on to WJCU.org and hit the Pledge Online button. Make your donation to help support the station. We even have lovely parting gifts for a donation of $25 or more. And it's painless. All right, I want to introduce you to a very knowledgeable and passionate guy. Corey Greenberg has ulcerative colitis. It's a nasty disease, and it almost cost him his dream of becoming a pro bicycle racer on a pro team. Instead, he's been in remission for almost a decade, and now, as an ambassador for the IBD community, is getting ready to race the 2021 season as well as launch his new website, both in an effort to bring understanding and information to anyone and everyone who has one of the diseases associated with IBD or knows someone who does. Hi, Corey. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
It's my pleasure. You have a great story to tell. So can we begin with your background, where you grew up, how you got into cycling, and what almost derailed your career? And that pun was intended, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up just northwest of Los Angeles in a town called Simi Valley in California. I got into cycling at the end of high school. So I was kind of one of those individuals that was enjoying watching the last years of Armstrong and was really kind of motivated by that. And I went and bought my first mountain bike at 18 years old and got in my first couple junior races as a mountain bike racer and found myself having a pretty good success, and then decided to move over to the road, which I really enjoyed a lot. So I actually did my first junior race and was unfortunately disqualified because I had no idea that you had junior gearing at the time. So that was a wake-up call. And my dad and I, after the race, we went straight to the bike shop and tried to figure out that situation. And then and it just progressed from there. I did my first stage race and ended up winning a stage, taking second overall. And I was just, from that point, it was just, I knew exactly where I wanted to go. And so I got more involved in cycling and eventually wound up on a great U23 development team out of Los Angeles. And around the same time, ended up going to Europe and dabbling in some races over in Belgium. And then, so the path became pretty clear that I wanted to become a professional. But unfortunately, at age 21, I got diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. At that time, it was a really low down in my colon. So it was called sigmoiditis. And that is a form of IBD, which is inflammatory bowel disease. And that ended up progressing, even though I was, you know, finding new highs in my U23 career and really kind of breaking out, you know, having success at races like Tour Danae and getting the white jersey there and just really having standout performances. Unfortunately, by the time I was 23, I ended up becoming hospitalized and my career was unfortunately put on hold. And I didn't know if I was ever going to be able to race or ride a bike again, as doctors were telling me the likelihood of losing my colon due to this condition was pretty severe. But fortunately, I overcame and I took the lessons that I learned through my cycling career And, you know, 10 years on, I'm living in remission and have had a successful racing career and still racing to this day, and now promoting IBD awareness through my racing career as well.
Wow, what a great story. So I have a couple of questions for those people who don't know a lot about the disease. It's very debilitating. It's very tough. Is it hard to diagnose? Is it clear how the diagnosis goes?
You know, in my case, actually, the first symptoms that I actually experienced were at a bike race. You know, a lot of it stems around what takes place and what transpires in a restroom. So it's a very embarrassing type of situation that you sometimes get put into. I think a lot of individuals are pretty hesitant about the diagnosis at first, just because, you know, it could be, you know, maybe you would attribute it to stress, or you attribute it to, you know, other underlying things. And in my case, I have pre-existing conditions within my family members. So I got a bit of guidance, but I was first misdiagnosed by a general doctor, and then I had gone and seen a gastroenterologist, and that's when I was diagnosed at 21 with a kind of a mild form of the condition.
Is it autoimmune based?
Yeah, yes, it is. Yeah, okay. It is an autoimmune condition. Yes. So, and IBD is obviously inflammatory bowel disease, and the two main components that you often see are Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis.
And they are different.
They are different. Yes. So Crohn's disease is mainly inflammation of the lining of the digestive tract, and it can involve deeper layers of digestive tissue. So anywhere from the mouth to the anus, that's where it evolves. But with ulcerative colitis, you're mainly looking at the large intestine, which is its inflammation and ulcers among the superficial lining of the large intestine and also the rectum. So it's definitely both digestive issues, and Crohn's seems to affect obviously more of the digestive tract, whereas colitis, what I have is mainly in the large intestine.
I know you're an ambassador for IBD and ulcerative colitis and Crohn's. I mean, just for the entire...
Yeah, IBD in a spectrum, and even chronic illness, because, you know, this is a chronic disease. So, you know, I take up the mantle for obviously the IBD community, which affects many people worldwide, but also those, you know, living with chronic illness.
So one of the questions I wanted to know is do you know what the incidence of IBD is among the general population? And does it affect athletes more? Oh, wait, if it's autoimmune, it probably wouldn't.
Well, you know, there's different incidence rates amongst different developing nations and developed nations. But like, for example, in the United States, it's about 1 in 100 people are living with IBD, so about 3.1 million.
Wow.
North America seems to have the highest along with like your Nordic countries and Northern Europe. They have a similar incident rate. So you're looking at like 3.6, 3.7 million people in Northern Europe. And that seems to be the highest places where you see these particular cases, mainly, you know, the Nordic countries, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, those type of places see it as well.
Do you see it more in men or women, or is it fairly an equal opportunity abuser?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It tends to be like a more equally dispersed, but in North America, you tend to see like younger Caucasian males at, you know, in their early 20s. Tend to be especially with ulcerative colitis, seem to be more prevalent. But if you look at like a lot of the studies and Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, you can see on crohnsandcolitisfoundation.org, they have really great diagrams which help you kind of break down at, you know, the different age brackets throughout the lifespan and how Crohn's and colitis seem to be affecting the population within North America. And, you know, in Europe, there's obviously a contrast to that. So you see the similar things with younger males, kind of like I did at my age. So I'm a typical case, but it can affect any, you know, adolescents as well. You tend to see more cases among young adolescent males than you do young adolescent females. But that also changes throughout the lifespan. So when you see female involvement with that typical diagnosis, that is, tends to be equal to that of men.
Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Corey Greenberg. He is an ambassador for the IBD, Ulcerative Colitis, Crohn's organization, a nonprofit, I assume there is involved with that. And he is a professional bike racer, and we're going to get to that in a few moments. I wanted to ask you about continuing to race your bike before you went into remission. What did they have to do to get you on your bike? And clearly you were hospitalized, so you had to take some time off.
Yeah, well, so, you know, this is a condition that it has points of remission and points of flare. It can be chronic or acute at times. So for my personal experience and my story, I was someone who was diagnosed, you know, at an age where, you know, as a U23 racer, I was somebody at the time when you're that young, sometimes you don't really take these diagnoses very serious. You know, you have such a objective before you. And that's, you know, for me was to become a professional athlete. So I wasn't going to let anything stop me. And so I didn't really take the diagnosis as seriously as I should. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that it can be a very embarrassing condition to live with. You know, it involves the restroom. Sometimes it involves medications that are of the suppository nature or enemas. And so, you know, if for a young male at that time, you know, you're in an environment where, you know, teammates might find that to be amusing or funny. So it just becomes a situation where I, at that time, wasn't very open with it and seemed to maybe not take the active course in probably what I should have done in terms of prevention and care. So the disease got worse. Namely, you know, it spread more throughout my colon and became what they call pancolitis, which is the entirety of the colon. And the colon has a mucosal lining, which was affected. And that's, as that becomes hindered, you get ulcers, which comes, you know, hence the name ulcerative colitis. So the colon began shutting down, and eventually I was hospitalized after, you know, trying to push myself through training and all these things. The body just became overworked. And I, you know, there was nights where I was sleeping on the bathroom floor, and just there's things, you know, like with related to blood and stool and things like that nature. And my mom at that time ended up finding me sleeping on the floor of the restroom. And I went straight to the hospital, and my gastroenterologist, who I'd been working with at that time, basically said, young man, you know, you're very sick. I'm not sure what the, you know, the outcome's going to be. So I was in the hospital for quite a while. And at that time, I started a biologic therapy. And so it's a progressive medication, kind of second generation medication that is, you know, out there for people with this particular condition. And luckily, that medication started working for me. And so I was able to, you know, leave the hospital with, you know, on the right foot. But at the time, really, I took the knowledge that I gained through cycling, and which was, you know, when you're trying to win a bike race or a series of bike races or whatever it may be, you plan out your season and you look at every aspect of bike racing, whether it be from your frame to your wheels to your diet to how your coach and you are preparing. You know, there's so many elements that are involved in just getting to that finish line. And so as a young, you know, athlete, you take those lessons, and I kind of turned that into fighting this new battle, which was, you know, overcoming this condition and overcoming these hurdles. And so I took every aspect of my life, whether it was what I was doing with my gastroenterologist or my diet, you know, seeing my chiropractor, mental health, all these different elements, and I turned it into what you would say is a training regimen. And I attacked this condition. And fortunately, you know, through hard work and dedication, which cycling instilled in me, I was able to kind of create a path forward. And so that's kind of what led me back to a remissive state and to be able to maintain remission all these years and ultimately continue training and working towards, you know, becoming a professional. And now, you know, in my early 30s, I've been in this career for a little while, and, you know, hopefully we'll stay there for a little bit longer and be able to promote kind of this awareness and this community so that more people who are in my shoes have a bit better path forward and kind of know it's okay to be outspoken and to talk about your condition and not be afraid and seek the help that's out there. And so that also the general public is more aware of what, you know, these individuals are facing.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with Corey some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're speaking with Corey Greenberg. He just has a wonderful story. I mean, it's not great that you have this disease, but the way you've managed it and the way you've approached it is relatively unusual and clearly successful. So you mentioned diet and you mentioned chiropractic and you mentioned a lot of the regimen that you did. Tell me about diet. I think that a lot of people don't understand that, you know, you are what you eat, and clearly that has made a difference for you. What is your diet?
Yeah. So, you know, I've always taken the approach, especially after my diagnosis, you know, prior to that, you know, as a young athlete, you know, we're not really taught per se, like what to do, when to eat. You know, it's an evolving regimen, right? Over time, as become more, you know, a student of the sport and a student of nutrition and things like that. But after my diagnosis, you know, I really, really fine tuned it and started seeing a professional, someone that has the you know, wherewithal to take the condition, take where I am in life, take where I am in sport, and help me kind of create a regimen. So my current diet is it transforms throughout, you know, the year as the needs change as an athlete, but with the underlying thought of, okay, you have this condition and you need to be cognizant of that condition. And so looking at different things that have caused what I call gut distress, you know, I kind of look at the diet and say, well, this particular food irritates my gut, or this particular food can be prone to irritate the gut. And for me, it's all about the approach of keeping a healthy gut and keeping that microbiome, which is living in your gut. You know, we think of probiotics that help build up that microbiome, which is so key, especially in maintaining that mucosal layer in your large intestine. So it's looking at things that promote that microbiome for me, and also things that aren't going to irritate, things that, you know, like for instance, for me, I don't know why, but things like cauliflower, quinoa, that tends to bother me, but it might not others. So it's a very fluid diet where you tend to have to work to figure out kind of the triggers. And then also knowing, you know, like the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, for example, has great nutritional information on their website. And then I've always encouraged people who are dealing with conditions like this to reach out to experts to help you really fine tune, you know, what you're dealing with. And a lot of the modern research that's taking place is looking at how diet is becoming more involved. You know, one of the funny stories that I always tell people is the first thing after weeks of not being able to eat food and being on a liquid diet in the hospital and things like that, the first meal I received actually once my doctor approved me to start eating again was a grilled cheese sandwich. And I always laugh at that because it's like, man, it tasted so good after weeks of not being able to, you know, eat anything. And you know, grilled cheese sandwich, you know, it was just amazing. But was it the right thing at the right time? I don't know. You know, I cut out gluten, I cut out dairy at the time. You know, that was what was advised. And so there sometimes might be a disconnect. You know, everybody has their path and has their expertise. And so that's why I always encourage people to seek professional advice, especially when it comes to diet and looking at people that is their path of expertise and working in that realm and creating that environment where, you know, you have your gastroenterologist as your main support. And then, you know, you bring in your nutritionist as someone to back up your gastroenterologist and back up that program. So you really, it's, there's a lot of great information out there. And that's what I'm trying to, you know, help get out there through my story and through the involvement that, you know, cycling has given me a platform to be outspoken about. So.
What is medical research finding today? Have there been some inroads into resolving the problem, maybe on a genetic level or DNA level? Well, that's the same
thing. Oh, yeah. There's some great stuff. So, you know, if you were diagnosed back in, let's say, the 80s or 90s, there was a lot less treatment options out there. My great-grandmother died of complications from Crohn's disease. So, you know, could that have been something that was preventable if it was today? Absolutely. But, you know, back, you know, years ago, it's, you know, these are issues that weren't really kind of something we dealt with. I mean, even John F. Kennedy was dealing with those types of conditions as well. So a lot of notable individuals, you know, recently the Prime Minister of Japan had to step down because of ulcerative colitis. So, you know, this is definitely something that we've progressed really far, especially in the biological therapeutics. You know, that's kind of the second generation. And we're even looking at, you know, beyond that And then also the study of the microbiome. So, you know, those microorganisms, the bacteria that are living in your gut, and how diet plays a role in that, how probiotics play a role in that, like preventative care, you know, how vitamin D plays a role in the immune system, because this is an autoimmune disease. And then absolutely environment and genes is something that they're looking at. So how do your genes really play a role in the disease and maybe being more preventative? And then looking at, like, if you want to get really involved, there's great things like the Crohn's and Colitis Congress. And that is every year they have like a symposium of, you know, the best medical minds and individuals within this realm. And they kind of lay out all the great new treatments and ideas and kind of what the levels of study that are being taken place. And one of the things that I thought was really neat in this latest 2021 version was looking at vagal nerve stimulation. And so that's a nerve that runs from your cranium, comes out behind your ear,
right,
and actually interjects with your large intestine. And being that, you know, in the world of sport, we kind of sometimes are afforded, you know, information that might not be in kind of the general public realm or, you know, pushed in, you know, typical medical realms. But in sport, there's a whole other line of research. And, you know, working with my chiropractor, working with individuals in that sphere, you know, we kind of look at like vagal nerve and how that interjects with your neck and, you know, doing exercises each morning to kind of make sure that your nervous system is taken care of. And, you know, we ride bikes all day long, or we sit at the computer and we kind of hunch, we have our shoulders up into our ears sometimes. And, you know, that puts pressure on the vagus nerve. And so, you know, there's cool things that come out, you know, with respect to alternative views and alternative thoughts like the vagal nerve or diet, which maybe 10 years ago we weren't really looking at. So a lot of cool progressive stuff that are coming. And I hope one day, you know, we can find a cure. And especially, you know, with lowering the incident rates of colon cancer, which we've started to see with the progression of biologics being more readily available and used by patients.
Well, it sounds to me like you have a career after racing.
this is something I'm passionate about.
Yeah, I can hear it. It's clear.
I love it. And I love being able to be a cyclist and use this platform, because to me, cycling is the greatest sport. I might be a little bit biased, but, you know, it's recreationally, it's the fastest growing sport in America. And I think with the advent of e-bikes and being very inclusive, it's allowing more people, especially those with gut issues. You know, a lot of times, you know, you hear runner's gut, you know, and that tends to be, you know, the jarring of your colon. You sometimes see acute issues with gut distress.
Right.
And so, and that's hard with people living with gut issues. So where the bike tends to be, you know, less impact and less strainful. And so to me, I think it's just a beautiful way to be able to spread a message and to also inspire people, but ultimately encourage health and fitness for the IBD community.
So you are still on a cycling team?
Yes. So I still race professionally full time.
And who do you race for?
Yeah. So I'm racing for a team out of Germany, and I'll be announcing the actual team here in the coming weeks. So
Okay. If
everybody wants to stay tuned for that,
we will do that.
It'll be a great announcement. You can see that we'll be doing it through a website that I'm actually launching here pretty soon, and also through my social media channels. So I'm excited to be able to bring IBD awareness into professional cycling. So it's going to be a cool experience for everybody.
Well, it's been interesting because I know we've had a lot of people with diabetes who have become professional cyclists, and that's a cause. We've had, during the Lance Armstrong days, of course, you had cancer as a cause with the Armstrong Foundation. And now, you know, you're doing this. I think that athletes as professionals, along the lines of entertainers as professionals, can be in a place to give people a lot more information and a lot more encouragement to find and, you know, seek cure or at least treatment. Tell me about your goals for 2021. What, I mean, 2020 was kind of a crapshoot year. I don't know what happened for you, but.
Yeah. You know, in a way, 2020 was a blessing in disguise in terms of not so much as an athlete. I mean, I dealt with, you know, I think a lot of people during COVID here, you know, we dealt with a lot of mental, you know, things. And as an athlete, you know, when you take the carrot away from the athlete and take away the, you know, the structure of your existence, it was really hard. But at the same time, it laid the groundwork for 2021 because the idea of inspiring people with IBD and inspiring this community for health and fitness purposes and to show the general public, you know, what IBD is and to become more aware of that situation, 2020 kind of laid this fabric of, hey, you know, how can we progress the awareness in this age of COVID? And luckily, through my friends over at the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation and my friends at Zwift, we were able to create the first ever IBD cycling event on Zwift. And we had over 1,500 people attend our Zwift event. And we were able to create a Crohn's and Colitis Foundation cycling kit that people could buy, which will match that of the game. So we created this new world on Zwift for the IBD community. But, you know, it's not exclusive to the IBD community. We had people from all over the world and a lot of individuals that were there to support their friends who had IBD or someone that they lost to IBD or to colon cancer or just people that wanted to come and ride and support. Or actually, we, you know, it was great to see how many people living with this condition are on a bike. And, you know, we created this environment for people to feel comfortable in their own home on a trainer. And, you know, they don't have to worry about, hey, where's the restroom when I'm out riding on the road or not feel quite comfortable to be able to go out on the road. So this kind of laid the framework for what 2020 is going to look like. And that's just going to be using professional cycling events to be able to showcase what is possible with IBD, to show like through events where I'm racing that, hey, you know, here's someone from your community and we're partaking in these events. So it shows, you know, what is possible. Also with using those as the way to be a loudspeaker for the advocacy side so that the general public knows, hey, what is IBD? You know, sparking their curiosity or sparking the curiosity of individuals that are dealing with these conditions to be more aware of, oh my gosh, there are these resources out there. Like I was in my shoes many years ago and not knowing where to turn. Hey, maybe someone sees this and is able to find the helpful resources. And then keep expanding on our community on Zwift to create more frequency of events. So that way we have an outlet to encourage health and fitness for the IBD community. And also with the launching of my own personal campaign, which I'll have a website that'll be launching in the next few weeks. And through that, we're going to have a place for people to come and build a community to share their stories so that people can go on there and read about what others are facing to find a sense of friendship and a sense of community to be able to, you know, learn, hey, there's all this guy out there, you know, I'm going to, you know, connect with this person and we can, you know, ride together on Zwift, for example. And also to give people the information and a pathway to find out, you know, what can I do moving forward to be able to look at all aspects of my life and achieve some sort of health and wellness, especially living with this condition. So it is a growing movement, and I look to expand on that in 2021. And I think we're making some positive inroads. And we'll take this well way beyond 2021 and into the future. And I think eventually I would love to see IBD having a ride similar to like the MS ride, where people can not only virtually, but actually post-COVID in a world where we can gather again, ride together and support a cause and raise some great money and great awareness for people.
Corey, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. Please tell my listeners how they can stay in touch with you and get ready to watch you as you launch your website, as you launch your European career for 2021. What's a good way to contact you?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Instagram at CoreyMike23. That's a great way to find out like my latest things that I'm posting, articles, such type of related stuff. And then also here in the future, rideforibd.com. That'll be my latest website that'll be launching. It's just ride, the number 4, and ibd.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn if you're looking to, you know, get in touch and talk to me personally and see a you know, how we can kind of move forward to help whether you have another organization or something within the IBD spectrum. That's a great way to get in touch with me as well.
Thank you so much for talking with me, Corey. It's just been a delight. And your enthusiasm, your excitement for what you're doing. I love talking to cyclists, as everybody knows, and especially somebody who is just so passionate about getting that word out.
You're welcome.
We've been talking with Corey Greenberg. You can follow him at CoreyMike23 on Instagram, Ride4 with the number 4, IBD.com. In the future, that website's about to go up. And find Corey on LinkedIn. I hope we get to talk again and have a great 2021.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Corey Greenberg joined me from his home in California. We will soon see his website, ride4ibd.com. And in the meantime, if you'd like to contact Corey or follow him, you can find him on LinkedIn or go to his Instagram at CoreyMike23. My thanks to Corey and, as always, to George Mount for joining me on the show this week. Next week, we'll talk with Jason Huntsman and Aaron Frank from Serial One e-bikes, as well as meet one of the most fascinating of characters, Brent Barber, founder of the Bicycle Film Festival. One more shot about Radiothon. Please take a moment to make your donation to the cause. Log on to wjcu.org and do your thing. We will be most appreciative. Remember, you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. Leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, and please take a moment to rate the podcast on your favorite app. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Stay safe, stay well, and if you have any chance whatsoever, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and we welcome your thoughts and comments. We'll be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and most other podcast apps and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.